You're listening to Star Wars Beyond the Films, the official expanded universe podcast of StarWarsReport.com.
There is a great disturbance in the Force.
Welcome to episode number 28 of Star Wars Beyond the Films, your Star Wars discussion podcast. We broadcast on Middle Earth Network Radio as well as on the Star Wars Report website. Our episodes are also available, of course, on our own Facebook page, facebook.com/SWBeyondFilms. But enough about how you got here, because we're just glad you are here. Let's get the show started. I am one of your hosts, Nathan P. Butler. With me, as always, my stalwart companion, the defender of the EU, Mr. Mark Herleman. Hey, Mark.
Hey, Nathan, everybody out there, Whistler. Yes, I remember to introduce you for once. You should be happy, you ungrateful little droid. It's so good to be here. I tell you, this is a stress-relieving thing. Just coming here, sitting here with you, Nathan, chatting for the fans, talking about some Star Wars Expanded Universe. I'm just so happy to get it kicked off.
Please tell me you're not in your underwear. Please tell me you're not in your underwear. I'm just saying.
No, I'm fully dressed. I'm actually wearing my black Rebel logo crest shirt. Every time I put this on, I always feel like Wedge Antilles in, Legacy of the Force?
Nice. It's funny, every time I put my glasses on, I feel like I'm Harry Potter. Wait, no, that's just the mirror. Anyway, what are we talking about this time, Marcus? This is going to be a subject that we've been excited to talk about for a while, but we didn't feel like we could until the last issue was out. What's going on this time?
Well, here at Star Wars Beyond the Films, we ask the tough questions. Questions that have bothered you a long time, or simple ones that have perplexed you off and on. You ponder about Star Wars, and so do we. This episode, we look at the first arc of Dawn of the Jedi, from issues 0 through 5. We look at it all, we focus on it, we're going to explore it, we're going to have a good old time. Consider this your spoiler warning, because here we go.
That's right, the first story arc here, Force Storm. This, I got to tell you, I mean, this is a series that I was excited about when they first announced it, but I was kind of like, really, they're finally going there? Jan Dersima and John Ostrander are probably the best team out there when it comes to Star Wars comics. I mean, Ostrander tends to do it very, very well. He doesn't have a lot of off issues. You know, so even someone like John Jackson Miller rocks it when it comes to Knights of the Old Republic, but I really wasn't as fond of Knights of the Old Republic War. You know, it seemed like it was a little off from the previous stuff, yet Knight Errant is growing and turning out very well. This group, it's really a duo that doesn't seem, at least in the last few years, to have ever hit much of a downward turn. They're always very solid. And to see them now putting her awesome art talents along with his great writing talent, combining their ideas story-wise into something that's essentially a co-creation, giving us something that's an origin of the Jedi, is just it's fantastic to me. I mean, they've gone to the far future, relatively speaking. Now they're in the way, 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 way far past, or I guess as the first issue calls it, a long, long time ago on planets far, far away. This was a thrill just to hear announced, and I'm glad to say that the first story arc has, I think, fulfilled expectations, especially when you read it in one sitting.
Yeah, you know, you mentioned John and Jan. They're my dream team. They're, I don't know, what you would probably say a lot of Timothy Zahn fans fall victim to. I fall victim to here. Most of my favorite comics were done by John or Jan. Now, John Jackson Miller, he's kind of like the solo player out there, you know, coming, raising up. I like KOTOR War. I thought it was really cool. But then again, Mandalorian Knights are just my cup of tea. But when it comes down to Dawn of the Jedi and them going way back, you know, Nathan, you hit it right on the head. They went to the far past or far future and now coming way into the past. And I loved what they did in the future. And the way that the past kicked right off, it was like, whoa, what is this? What's going on? They're shaking things up. And I love that. It felt like we were getting an infinity almost, and yet it falls into our C-level canon.
Mm-hmm. I guess we could sort of do the audience a favor here. If you're not someone who has read Dawn of the Jedi much yet, you're going to read it, or this might get you excited to read it, we should probably make sure that the chronology of this makes sense, okay? If you open up the first page of either issue 0 or issue number 1, okay, actually all the ones, I guess, now. If you look at anything from Force Storm, what you're going to find is it says that the events in this story begin approximately 36,453 years before the Battle of Yavin. We now, of course, know that thanks to the Old Republic's sort of, not revisioning of the timeline, but being a little more specific instead of approximating the timeline, that the Republic was actually founded 25,053 years before A New Hope, as opposed to just straight 25,000. That's a little misleading, though, because the actual story itself does not take place in the year that it lists. It starts there. Issue number one starts with sort of the early origins of the Jedi, or the Jedi, on Tython, but then it jumps, and it jumps, and it jumps, and it jumps, until you get to about the middle of the issue, and then they pick up with the present day. Kind of like Legacy, where Broken started with the earlier times with the attack on Ossus and Cade when he's younger, and then by about the end of the issue or partway into the next one, I forget which one it was, but very shortly, you wind up with adult Cade. Same kind of thing here, except it's by thousands of years. The bulk of this story, Force Storm, takes place in the year 25,793 years before the Battle of Yavin, which, if you look at the Old Republic timeline, by the Old Republic I mean the game, if you look at that, it says that the Force War, the first great light side versus dark side war, was in the year 22,140 before the Treaty of Coruscant. Well, if you take that number and add in the date of the Treaty of Coruscant, 3,653 BBY, you've got this year. So apparently this is the buildup to that Force War, that decade-long Force War that's been hinted at in guidebooks and in the video games. Finally, we're going to get a chance, it looks like, to see it. But we need to keep in mind, this is not just early stuff. This is pre-Republic. The Republic is not going to be around at this point for over another 700 years. There's no Republic to speak of. It is a very different era, which is why, Mark, you said that this kind of felt like a reboot. Is that where you come at it from, the reboot side, that it's just so different that anything goes? Is that the feel here?
There is a little of that. I mean, you know, you mentioned how it's in a different location. We're in, like, the deep core at this point. We're in one system, in a sense. I mean, like you said, we go back, way back, to the beginning of the galaxy, far, far away. And we get the flashback. I don't know. It felt like the Big Bang Theory of the EU, in a sense, where it touched, you know, these events and those events and this event. And all of a sudden, we got the Thoyor ships, which are a lot like Mortis, by the way. Mm-hmm. Which to me, okay, I saw those and I thought, okay, this is Mortis. Obviously, we're tying it in immediately.
Hopefully.
I do. I am hopeful in this situation. Granted, other books have come out and I'm like, why are you tying it to Mortis? But this one, in this case, it was like, okay, I can dig it. But the thing for me that struck me as the most different was they're not Jedi. They're Jedi or Jedi, or it's spelt a little different. It almost felt Yuuzhan Vong every time I'd say it in my mind.
Jedi!
Yeah, and we have Sith, the species, the red-skinned species that would later end up becoming Maasai at some point through some experimentation. But we have the original Sith even are Jedi. Mm-hmm. And the way that the Thoyor ships go about gathering everyone, bringing them to Tython in this little small little bubble. I kind of see it as like a bubble in a bubble kind of thing. You know, the galaxy that we always knew about in the EU, it's out there, but everybody's not attached. There's no hyperspace. They're all on their own planets doing their own thing. They don't know about any of this stuff. And in the middle of it all, in the deep core that we talk about Palpatine back in Dark Empire, where he's hiding in Abyss, in that deep, thick, nasty core of stars is where Tython is. And these guys are completely, you know, cut off from everybody, because that's how the Thoyor set it up. Mm-hmm. And the way that they perceive the Force and the way the Force reacts on that planet is something that, to me, just it feels like, it almost feels like how Mortis was, where it didn't feel like it was George Lucas, but yet that was George Lucas approved, where you're like, wait a minute, what is going on? I don't even understand this. The balance, wait, whoa, what are we doing with balance? The whole concept of balance in this story, it blows my mind.
Yeah, this is it is a weird thing. I think that bubble within a bubble type of analogy works really well. It's kind of like one of the things that was emphasized a lot when I was first getting introduced to Wars, before ever writing for it, when I didn't know what the heck it was. They said, okay, here's the thing. It's like this space opera type thing. There's a lot of factions. There's a lot of places for dynamic interaction, but understand it's just our solar system, and that's what makes it special. It's confined and yet expansive at the same time, and I never thought I'd see a Star Wars story do that. And this one, for the most part, is set just in the Tython system. You've got Sunspot, Malterra, Nox, Krev Khor, I think is how you pronounce it, then Tython with its two moons, Ashla and Bogan, right? The old names we were always told that represent light side, dark side. That's where they got the idea.
Love that tie, too. And that's one of the things about John and Jan's works that I love. They tie things in to stuff that you would only see in role-playing games, an occasional small reference here or there in a book, and they're masterful at it.
Yeah, and you've got, I mean, they expand it. You've got Calamar, we don't know much about. Shikaqua is this planet that's essentially like their version of like a Nar Shaddaa, Nal Hutta. It's where the crime families live. Skagora, Obri, Maur we've got, and Fury's Gate, which is the furthest out, which has this space station. And apparently they've sent these sleeper ships out of the system, but none have ever returned. So you figure, okay, for them, it's all bottled up. We got these starfighters and such, but you don't have anything along the lines of a regular hyperspace type of drive or hyperdrive. But because of this time period, the big bads aren't the Sith. I mean, the Sith species haven't been visited by Dark Jedi yet. There are no Dark Jedi yet. Instead, what you've got is the Rakatan Infinite Empire that was originally set up within the first KOTOR game. And with that, we get to see sort of the outside universe through a different perspective. I mean, we don't see a whole lot, but we see Biss. We see a Rakatan base on Bith, their stronghold for, I think, what is his name? Is it Seknos? I think. Seknos is the Sith. Skalnas is the Praetor who is on the Rakatan Praetor who's on Biss. And we get to see. I loved it. And it's something that would slip by a lot of people when you see it. Because it's a scene that happens really quickly, and there's a lot of stuff happening in this story. But in the first issue, I believe it was, we see Tatooine when it had oceans.
Yeah. Oh, God, I went nuts.
It's Tatooine before the Rakatans terraformed it, and we meet the Kamunga. Now, if you remember the Kamunga being mentioned in the KOTOR games, the Kamunga are the species that, after being messed with by the Rakatans, and after the Rakatans changed Tatooine, they became the Sand People and the Jawas. We are seeing the ancestors of these film species. They're doing a great job of saying, we're going to show you the galaxy at large in this time period. We're going to show you all kinds of awesome stuff out there. But our only key to doing that is the Rakatans, okay? Because the Tython system is where most of our drama is going to take place. But, oh, you're going to get those glimpses. And I think they do a really good job of balancing. It's easy to get into the world-building thing and just spend the whole issue talking about, here's what happened, and here's what happened, and here's what happened, and here's what happened. Here's this place, and this place, and this place, and this place, and this term, and this term. And instead, it's a whole lot of information in number zero, which is like a guidebook, and a whole lot of information in number one. And then they, like, take a breath. And then they go through, and the story unfolds. And as it unfolds, we get more information. It's not info dump after info dump after info dump, which I was kind of afraid we would see, but I was... You know, I was pretty confident that Ostrander, the way he writes, wasn't going to wind up doing that beyond maybe the first chunk of the first issue or two. And it's a fascinating time period. I got a feeling that we're going to wind up seeing this become a couple of episodes of Star Wars Beyond the Films, because we're both caught up, I guess, in the energy of this now that we can finally talk about a completed story.
Well, and you talk about these info dumps. I mean, Legacy had a 0 and a 0.5, and I was kind of shocked that we haven't already got word of a 0.5. When I think about Legacy and how successful those 0 and 0.5s were in giving you information that would get touched on throughout the comic, I felt it was vital to get more out of your story by knowing that background information, because things were sliding past you. I mean, like you mentioned with Tatooine, I was going nuts at the oceans, but the founding members, you know, species of the Sand People and the Jawas totally slipped past me. You know, you mentioned that just now, and I was like, ooh, you know, getting all giddy. It's one of those things, though. You mentioned the Rakatan Empire. It's kind of like Namor in the New Jedi Order, where you need to have the villain's outlook. I mean, granted, we also get Zesh's outlook, too, but he's more the wild card, I would say. You know, it's like, yeah, he's evil, but he's kind of like the Silver Surfer kind of evil. You know, he's like glad because it's forcing him to go find planets and destroy them. But I love the fact that because we have the Rakatan, we see what we saw in KOTOR as it's happening. Because in KOTOR, it was all like, oh, this happened way long time ago kind of thing. And it gets back to those touches that they do. And for me, like I said, John and Jan are my dream team. And for me, one of the things I love the most about another author is John Jackson Miller, because he seems to take that page from them and focus on what they've done and do something similar in his own respect. And so it's great when you see authors that consistently nail it inspire other authors. Timothy Zahn did the same thing with Alston, with Stackpole. You know, these guys inspire each other, and it's always great when you see that. And anytime you see Jan's artwork, I just, like I said, you know, Dream Team, 100% fanboying out right here. I mean, I love her Jedi. I love the outfits, the details, you know, all the attention put into the minute details. I mean, you know, you got to go out and get these Zero books. You don't have to, but I can't say enough how great it is going to change the story for you. I mean, you get things like the code, you get the setup of what's going on, like Anil Kesh. The Temple of Science. You know, they give you a little background on that, and it had me so perplexed. You know, you mentioned that taking a breath after the first two issues. I had so many questions when they were done. I was like, no, go back. I want to know. And that to me is like the offside about when you go in one direction or the other. There's that wanting to go even farther. And I mean, it can get annoying, I'm sure, but I love it.
And, you know, knowledge is a good thing. I think that makes for a good place for us to start into really getting into the setting, and then we can kind of go settings and technology and characters as we go along, kind of break this down. Otherwise, I got a feeling it's just going to be a lot of ooh, ooh, ooh from both of our sides, like, this is fun. No, you said knowledge, and we get the Jedi oath. There is no ignorance, there is knowledge. Sounds kind of familiar. There is no fear, there is power. That almost sounds Sith-like. I am the heart of the Force. I am the revealing fire of light. I am the mystery of darkness, in balance with chaos and harmony, immortal in the Force. These Jedi, from the standpoint of the setting here, you touched on it a little bit there. Tython is a planet where the Force is so entwined in the world that it's very much like Mortis inside the Mortis monolith, where the actions of light side and dark side movements in the Force, attitudes, actions, and such have a direct bearing on the balance of the planet's ecosystem. These Jedi, or Jedi, whatever, these early versions of the Jedi Knights that we see later, they are essentially striving for balance within themselves, a very, you know, balancing light and dark, very much like what we got out of, say, the Mortis trilogy, or even, in a sense, sort of the philosophies of Verger and Jason Solo, the idea that it's not light or dark, it's a balance between the two, that sort of thing. Very Taoist, I guess, to a degree. And it's like they're striving for that balance within themselves so as not to be destructive to themselves or others, but if they lose that balance, the planet suffers. Others suffer. They make a point in the first issue of talking about how you know, with the way that Tython's environment is and how harsh it can be, the people who happen to have been born without Force attunement really weren't equipped to live there, which is why they went to settle other planets in the first place.
Sleeper ships were needed in that regard.
Yeah, so there's not really what we would think of as light side or dark side. It's essentially all the Force looking for balance. I mean, they acknowledge light and dark, but it's not like there's a light side Jedi and a dark side Jedi, I guess is what I'm getting at here, that there may be two sides, but they're trying to find the balance between them. And if you miss that balance, you are expected to go up to one of the moons, either Ashel that represents the light side, Bogan which represents the dark side. Go to one of those moons, whichever one you are most in tune with in your actions, and meditate on the opposite. So for instance, we have a Jedi who used to be Quan Jang's student named Dagan Loke. And Dagan Loke, he apparently goes to the dark side, or goes too far towards the dark side, and winds up being essentially banished to Bogan, which is the dark side moon, and he is there supposedly to meditate on the light side. Though when we see him, I'm not sure to what degree he's actually done a whole lot of meditating on the light side. So our setting gives us a new version of Jedi. It gives us Tython, it gives us the space. I guess the technology is another thing that gives us a good part of the environment. I would say the one thing that stands out to me technology-wise, or I guess two things, but they kind of tie together, is the Rakatan technology. The Jedi have their own technology in the Tython system, but I mean, we're talking swords and such. You say, well, how do you have lightsabers whenever they were attached by power packs in those earlier stories? And this is way earlier than that. Well, it's because they're not lightsabers. They're Force sabers, essentially drawing on the dark side. And it took me a little bit to realize this, but the Force saber that Zesh is carrying and that the other Force Hound Trill is carrying, the end of it, the end that's not ignited, has like this fan blade looking kind of edge to it. And if you look at that, that's the same design as the rear and even some of the front of the Rakatan ships that we see briefly. And it's the same design, basically, albeit without the ball in the center, of the Starforge.
Oh,
from the KOTOR games. It is literally drawing on the Force. It's that Rakatan Force-based technology, and they designed the look of the technology in almost every respect to reflect the design of the Starforge. To me, the setting is almost a character in and of itself. What stood out to you? I mean, of all that, so I kind of laid out kind of the generalization smorgasbord here. What's the big one? I mean, I love the Force Saber myself, but... You know, I'm a big fan of like the purplish color. I want one now. Jody will mock me because I love the color purple. It's my college colors. But Force Saber for me, hands down, has to be the thing that was surprising and yet the coolest.
Well, hands down, I love the Force Saber. Don't get me wrong. I'm a Dark Saber fan. I'm a lightsaber fan. I think I liked the most about it was that it was interesting that the first ones to have anything like that technology or inspired that technology was the dark side. For me, it was the Ashlyn and the Bogan. The fact that those concepts that, you know, for EU fans, you know, they've been hinted about, talked about, you've heard about it, and the fact that they were brought to the focus. And like, you know, going back to that issue zero, when it talks about it, you had mentioned Dragon Locke. Well, it almost seems like they preset stuff up. You know, you mentioned how they go to one or the other to if they stray too far to the light or the dark, they're deemed out of balance. Those who veer too much to the light are sent to Ashla to contemplate Bogan. Those who walk too far into the dark are sent to Bogan, where they can meditate on Ashla until they find their way back to balance. And then it puts a dash, if they ever do. Now, it doesn't really necessarily say that it's only the dark side, but I find it interesting that if they ever do is attached to the sentence about those on the dark side. And that's where Dagon Locke is. He's over there. But it also ties into another aspect of the story that, like, by story's end of the first arc, Zesh is all but sentenced to go to Bogan and contemplate the light. And Shay is like, well, all he's ever known is the dark side. And I found that whole concept of how they do it. Plus, well, what if you never knew what the light was? And it made me think about the Vong again, you know, because that was a concept that was always coming up with me in philosophy when the New Jedi Order came out. It was like, what did it mean to exist and not exist in the Force? And what does it mean to, you know, to strive balance? Now I'm looking at it and it's like, whoa, you know, that's a concept. Like I said, that's one of the keys of the reboot feel, is that it feels so foreign to what Lucas gives us. Granted, Mortis is along these lines, but Mortis was something like you've said before, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like it's a page out of Lucas's script that he's tore off and gave everybody a public copy. And then he was like, oh yeah, here's this other page I had.
Yeah, I gotta say, I'm kind of on the same page as far as the moons representing the light and dark, and the idea of the meditation being a big part of what made the culture. It almost made it feel more Earth-like, because you have a lot of situations in earthen culture, in human culture, in Terran culture, whatever, where you've had ancient religions that base a lot of their mysticism in one form or another on, you know, the sun, the moon, the stars, and that sort of thing. So it definitely gives it more of like a feeling like it, since it's drawing from earlier Star Wars history, it's drawing from earlier in our history, even though a lot of the influences that Lucas went to for things like the Jedi or the idea of the Republic based on the Roman Empire coming from the Roman Republic and such. Lucas is delving back into some of his own ideas, or I guess we're seeing them delve back into old Lucas ideas, not just Ashla and Bogan, but we've also got the Dai Bindu at the very beginning. The first group that we see picked up by the Tho'ur on Ando Prime are the Dai Bindu, and that's a name that goes back to some of the earliest scripts for A New Hope at the time. I have very strong thoughts on the character of Zesh, but I think I want to hold them until we actually talk specifically about the characters, as opposed to going back into just the one comment there. But definitely strong thoughts about Zesh.
Continuing on the technology and themes, the Jedi Peacemaker class cruisers have a almost naval look to them. I mean, it looks like a boat you would see floating in the ocean almost, instead of flying around in space. I like the design of it. Getting back to that, you know, the bubble within a bubble, and how you mentioned, you know, Typhon was kind of angry in a sense towards non-Force users, and they went on these sleeper ships. The sleeper ships was something that I was really ecstatic to see, because I recall stories that talked about sleeper ships and how that was like a big thing back in the day, and how the far-flung planets of the galaxy got human beings and all these other different races was because of these sleeper ships that were going here and there. And the fact that we saw everybody come to Typhon, they all get pulled into Typhon right there in the middle of the galaxy, and they kind of like cluster around, and you've got this hodgepodge of species and stuff. And now you've got sleeper ships going out and repopulating different parts of the galaxy, and they have no idea about their original cultures at this point anymore because we've jumped so far. It was another really cool and profound thing about this story. You know, I think we'll be talking about how it contrasts with Legacy quite a bit, but I like the way that this one, unlike Legacy, it set a lot of its own mythical backstory, whereas Legacy kind of built off of what we had in the EU and it was going farther into the future. I love the contrast here, and I think it's touching that Jan and John were the ones that did it. I mean, now we've got both ends covered by them.
And it's kind of interesting when you talk about, you know, the sleeper ships going out and how much they might know about their cultures. I mean, these are cultures that we're somewhat familiar with. We got the Sith, we got the Selkath, we've got Dathomiri women, or I guess Dathomiri, I guess men and women. I know we've seen women with Shae Coda, for instance. Wookiees, we've got Twi'leks, we've got the people from Ando Prime, we've got humans, we've got all these different species that we're somewhat familiar with already, whether from the games, the comics, whatever. And at one point, we have Quan Jang. Now, Quan Jang is he's a Jedi Master who sort of works with the beasts and such. He's a teacher for Shae Coda, who's a Dathomiri girl, kind of a bad attitude at times kind of character. But her parents were killed at one point. I guess, you know, kind of saving that for characters. But Quan Jang, suffice to say, is like their science expert. He feels like he's their big science guy. Now, he may be just one of many, but that's what he feels like. And Quan Jang at one point he's got a chance to check out the escape pod that Zesh uses. Essentially, Praedor Tokar, his Rakatan ship, makes it into the system because apparently Zesh the Force Hound was able to feel the presence of Typhon and guide the ship there. And then apparently Zesh killed his own Praedor, but he doesn't know why. The ship crashes, and Zesh is able to escape on an escape pod that lands pretty close by. That's how he survives where the other ones have not. So he's like the one thing that's really, really out of balance. And after he's gone, Quan Jang gets a chance to check out the escape pod. And he looks at the escape pod and recognizes, these are our words. This is our language. This is Orabesh. And it kind of makes me sit back and wonder, I mean, I would assume, because we're assuming that human beings evolved on Coruscant, or Notron, as it was called back then, about a million years plus before the events of A New Hope. We figure there's already humans and stuff like that out there. Otherwise, how could they have been taken and brought to Typhon? But you got to wonder how much of the culture outside, especially around the core, is a result not of that outside culture already, because most of those cultures don't have hyperspace technology yet. How much of that culture is actually culture that was essentially launched back out of Typhon? It's kind of the chicken or the egg thing, you know?
Like the Mayan theory, or the one's theory where alien spaceships came to the Egyptians and that's how the pyramids were. Or what was it? Stargate?
Like the Stargate kind of thing, the Chariots of the Gods, Eric von Daniken stuff. Kind of. Just the idea that, you know, it's kind of the chicken or the egg type of thing. Was Orabesh a language that they had before they got to Typhon? Or did they develop Orabesh on Typhon, and one of those sleeper ships at some point somehow spread Orabesh away? My guess is it's an outside language that just happened to have been brought to Typhon by these humans who were picked up by the Tho'yor. But it creates all these interesting different cultural elements of where does this originate? Like you said, it's a shock to find that lightsabers were essentially designed after Force sabers, and the Force sabers came, I mean, not only through the dark side first, but they weren't even a Jedi invention. Lightsabers might be, but the idea of these Force sabers, this is Rakatan technology. Not only were they creating things with Force energy that became the precursor to the hyperdrive, they were also creating things that became the precursor to lightsabers that are so iconic for Jedi and Sith, and yet, you know, it's another element of borrowed and maybe retrofitted type of technology. They're able to get away from the forced necessity. I find anything like that from a cultural standpoint fascinating because we don't get a lot of cultural anthropology in Star Wars. We don't get a lot of this is where this idea came from and how it grew. They tried it sometimes. You know, Tales of the Jedi did a good job of showing earlier technology. You know, you'd see the lightsabers, and then you'd see the sabers with the power packs, and you'd see the blades going back with the actual metal blades and so forth. But we don't get a lot of that. And it seems like this one, more than any other Star Wars series, might be the one that's trying to lay down those cultural antecedents to all these other things that we've seen before. Is it antecedents is the word I'm looking for? Predecessors, I know for sure, is the word I'm looking for. So let's drop antecedents. On the off chance, I used it wrong.
Well, you know, and Riptide. I just finished that book. Really good book, by the way. And we have, again, Rakuten technology there. And the way it was described was like it was almost a living metal. It moved, it shifted, it had a feel to it, it was alive. That's the one thing, like I said, you know, you have to have that Nominor type viewpoint. You have to have a villainesque outlook. And in this case, like you said, they represent that outer bubble, you know, what's going on in the galaxy as a whole. And when you think about how, you know, all these things have come from a race that is just really bent on evil, you know. It is kind of funny. And it goes back to that balance. Like, okay, obviously the outer bubble got so dark that the inner bubble had to be burst. And obviously Zesh was the key. I mean, you know, we talk about the Force War that goes on. Obviously his arrival is what sets everything into motion. And I will say this 5/6, if you want to count the zero, issue arc did a really good job of capturing that. The excitement, the look, you know, again, I go back to Jan's artwork. You know, you look and see the samurai type feel of the characters because they now have swords. And I like the fact that we didn't have lightsabers because it forced all the characters to have the swords. It wasn't just like, oh, it's a vibroblade. It was like, no, everybody had a sword. And that was the interesting thing. And I, you know, off the top of my head, I want to say, though, that they were able to block the force saber.
Mm-mm. No, they were – I was looking at this because it was something that kind of slipped past me the first reading. I reread these right before we were sitting down to record today, and they are Master Maydog, whoever that is, Master Maydog's Durasteel. And, I mean, so these are not even the, oh, well, it's not a lightsaber, but it's a sword that can block it, so it's just as good. None of that kind of stuff that we get out of a lot of later stories where all of a sudden, whenever the story needs it, there's yet another kind of metal that can block lightsabers. So lightsabers aren't all that awesome anymore. In this case, I mean, you wind up seeing Shay Coda and let's see, who else was it? Shay Coda, Tasha Rio, and Seknos, Seknos Wrath. They are in a really tough spot because we wind up, the first thing that we see Zesh do with them is cut their sabers or their swords into pieces. And they're forced to use, you know, their force talents, controlling the animals, force pushes. Seknos has invented a sort of a form of ball lightning that he uses. Yeah, I mean, it's weird because we're so used to thinking of the Star Wars mainstream as so technologically advanced. And yet, even relative to the outside galaxy, it seems like Tython is, I mean, it's almost backwater to a degree, in terms of their technology and their development. They're so focused on their own solar system, and yet here's the Rakuten zipping around, you know, a huge chunk of the galaxy.
You could almost say they're force-bound, you know, that they were too into maintaining their balance, that they ignored what was going on in the galaxy out around them. They were completely ignorant of it. You know, we talk about balance again. Another thing about this that I found interesting is, like, Shay, her and her master dealt in alchemy. Krayt dragon / rancor creature that she created, Butch. You know, that was cool. And it's one of those things, like, every time you hear alchemy, you never would think of a Jedi messing around with it. Well, these aren't Jedi. These are the Jedi, and they can do whatever the heck they want. And it was just one of those things where when we see the character and the way Shay interacts with the creature and the way her master interacts with her, and then they all have these visions of Kresh. I mean, again, the story moved well. Kresh was another one of those characters that, you know, you see him in his mask, and by episode 2, he removes his mask, and I remember being just completely dumbfounded. I thought 100% he was going to be Abyss. I thought that window in the front was a single eye.
Is that how you say it? Is it Kresh or Zesh? Because I thought it was Zesh.
I don't know.
I have no idea how to pronounce an X.
I don't
X
either.
X always gives me trouble, unless it's X.
I go back and forth. It's like Han and Han. It's like, I don't know. Lucas said both in the films if I watch it long enough. Dang
Mr.
it.
Mr. X. Although I will say, you know, you bring up the point about, you know, the character Butch, or the I guess you could sort of call it a character, the flying Rancor that was apparently brought from Dathomir when they brought the different Dathomiri women, which makes sense for Shay Coda to be working with the Rancor. But I gotta say, Butch as the name of a character, even if it's an animal, that goes right along with it's one of the three instances where I sat back shaking my head at some of the earthisms in these stories, because we also get Shay Coda, I believe, is either her or Tasha, saying bazillion. Like, you've told me this a bazillion times. And we have a Sekhnos who, at one point, when he, I guess he's saying hello to Shay. And he says, hola, H-O-L-A. So what? Spanish is ancient Sith? Are they trying to make a point about illegal immigration or something here? Is that what they're trying to do? I mean, it just kind of made me sit back and say, hola? Hola? I mean, it's weird enough that they're speaking English, but now they're mixing in a little bit of Spanish as well. I don't know. It kind of caught me off guard, I guess. The earthisms sometimes work and sometimes leave me shaking my head. And that was one of those head-shaking moments there. But you mentioned the alchemy thing. We have all these different Jedi temples, which is something that was really kind of a cool idea. I mean, we're so used to the idea of one Jedi temple, or there's Jedi academies spread out around the galaxy, but they're all kind of teaching the same thing. But on Tython, you got these different places where the Tho'yor ships essentially landed or planted themselves in some cases. Sometimes they're just hovering, but most of them kind of planted themselves in the ground. And we get, let's see, we got the Temple of the Arts, which is Bodhi, which we really haven't seen much of. Kaleth, the Temple of Knowledge. We get Anil Kesh, the Temple of Science. Maharakesh, the Temple of Healing. Vertep, the Forge, which is sort of like the, I guess, the creation of weapons and such. Qigong Kesh. They're really trying to mess us up with these names. Qigong. I guess that's Qigong. Qigong Kesh.
I don't know. I was like, it's Qui-Gon!
Right. We got Stav Kesh, the Temple of Martial Arts. We got Padawan Kesh, the Jedi Academy for the young ones. Akar Kesh, the Temple of Balance. I mean, we got all these different places, but they all have a specific function. It's almost like... And it's funny, it's almost like the weird cross between the way that we do things now with colleges, because you wind up going to college to focus on a major, to focus on one specific thing after you finish a general instruction everybody would get, like, say, a Padawan, like Padawan Kesh. Okay, fine, that's where you learn the early stuff. I wonder if that's where they got the name Padawan, or if they named it Padawan after the rank, you know, which came first again, chicken or the egg. But at the same time, some people, when they go to college, they major in liberal arts, which is sort of like majoring in nothing. You're going to do a little bit of everything, you know, jack of all trades, master of none. But you're getting a very broad base to go out into the world and then do something with those skills as you combine them and mix and match them as you need for whatever skills you're going to go into. And that's kind of what we've got here. It's like in the process of getting a liberal arts Jedi education, you're traveling and you're going from major to major to major to major until you figure out what should be your primary area, your major, and what'll be your force minor, so to speak. You know, it's really kind of an interesting take on it that, again, it's not quite what we've seen before, but it's enough like what we've seen before that we can buy it. We can say, this is Star Wars, I get it, this works for me, what's next? As opposed to it being, well, this isn't Star Wars, how could they do this? That kind of sort of fanboy gut reaction at anything that's new and tough to understand.
Yeah, you just gotta roll with it. I mean, like the Force Saber, I found the scenes where you were talking about where he cut the swords. And it didn't vroom. We had a voon, and then we have hish sounds. And I like how the sounds are different. I mean, even the Darksaber in the Clone Wars was a little different. But, okay, going back to those visions that we were talking about, each character in the comic has a vision of Kesh, Kresh, Zesh, however you want to say him. And Dagon Locke has one in the, let's see, the second
episode. They all have it in the same one, don't they? Because Sekhnos has one while he's flirting with the girls, and then Shay has hers while she's flying on Butch, and Tasha has hers when she's saving her dad from an assassination attempt. And we're like, okay, well, they're all being called together. They call them, what do they call them? Summonings or no?
Yeah, something along those lines.
Yeah, summonings. And then Dagon Locke is also getting it. I didn't even remember he had one until I'm getting toward the end. I'm like, oh crap.
Yeah, I'm looking at it and I'm like, wait a minute. They totally left his character completely alone till the end. I don't think we have another reference of him until the end after this point. This is in the second issue, and all we see is him walking. It shows Boggin, it goes zooms in on a city. Then you see a man sitting down. The man gets the vision. He stands up. He sees the vision. The vision disappears, and he goes, darkness. And it zooms up on his eye and his scar. And you're just like, wait, who? Wait, what? And it just gets done with Sekhnos' grandmother. She's sitting there talking to him and his dad. She's like, don't smirk, Tov. It doesn't suit a master. You indulge Sekhnos. Trust, or you indulge Sekhnos too much. Mark my words, he's going to wind up on Boggin, like Dragon Locke. And so it establishes, again, the whole, you know, if you read Zero, you knew Dragon Locke had gone to the dark side and was focusing on the light. But it seems like he was a lost cause to the other Jedi. And it's one of those things, you know, it was an open plot hole. You have to wonder where they're going to go with this. And that's, I think, for me, anytime I read a Star Wars comic series, by the time I get to the end of the arc, I'm always wanting to know, where are we going to go next?
Yeah, very much so. And this definitely, it left more open for the next storyline than I thought they were going to. It didn't end the way I expected. We've got the crash, and they get the summoning, you know, the three journeyers, I think is what they call the rank, the three Jedi journeyers. They head out there to find out what on Earth has just happened, what's this weird, dark feeling they're getting from the area around the Abyss of Rub, which is where crazy visions and stuff happen. I mean, think of, like, the Grand Canyon all as the cave on Dagobah. You know, that's the Abyss. And, you know, they're drawn there. We see them fight, and I'm figuring, okay, well, basically what we've got here is we're going to have a Darksider who's loose on the planet, or the Darksider's going to bring in the Rakatans, and there's where things are going to go. It never really occurred to me that we would truly see, almost a redemption, but essentially an opening of the eyes of Zesh, which, again, we'll get into when we talk more about the characters, but I think the way that they played out the story in giving us a chance to meet these characters, we get hints bit by bit of other aspects. You know, you don't want to wind up like Dagon Luk. We've got Rory, Finn, and Hawk Rio riding the same mount. And one of them, I guess it was Rory, is holding on to Hawk as they're riding the beast. And he's like, well, you know, in days past, you would have held me a little tighter than that. You know, I'm sorry, we can't be together, and you know why. And we're like, but we don't know why. And they're setting up, you know, bits and pieces. You know, we got Quan Jang, you know, I won't lose you the way I lost Dagon Luk. Oh, so he was the master of Dagon Luk. Interesting. They really do a good job of taking the bits and pieces and laying them out. I mean, you almost forget the first issue by the time you get to the fifth. But even in the first one, you know, we got to wonder, where is Tasha going to go with this? Because we've got the crime family. She's sort of like the person who, in a sense, is like Cade Skywalker, giving up her heritage, only she's giving up the non-Jedi heritage for the Jedi heritage. And, you know, we've got the elements revolving around the Despot War. We know a little bit about the Despot War from issue number one. We know a little bit about it from issue number zero. But for the most part, all we know is that's where Tasha's parents were killed. Or I guess not her parents. That's where... not Tasha, Shay's parents were killed, and Tasha's grandfather and eldest uncle were killed. Well, okay, tell us more. What's the effect of this? We only know bits and pieces. You know, it's kind of like the opening of any Clone Wars episode. Here's 30 seconds of a galaxy torn by war, and then we're into the episode, and we're wondering what has happened. They've essentially made it so that it's almost like certain elements of conversation within this first arc, Force Storm, it's the equivalent of a Star Wars opening crawl. You know, it's the bits and pieces. Yeah. Every once in a while, we get what feels like, that's the next paragraph of the opening crawl for this entire series. That's another setup. And like I said, it gives me hope for a series to really grow and develop out of this. I honestly, until I reread these, I would have said that I didn't feel like we got a lot of new character information so much as we got characters just kind of tossed out there, and we got a lot of background information, but didn't really get a feel like we were inside the characters' heads all that much. It was mostly them bickering or working together while they were fighting, depending on which issue you were looking at. But I think I was wrong. When I went back and reread these very quickly, there's a lot more character to these than I realized. It feels like the characterization is done so subtly in some cases that in all the action, it almost slips by.
I just, when I'm reading these comics, I'm always paying attention to the little details. Like, you know, we got Shay, her really cool-looking pants where you can see her shorts underneath them. That was kind of unique and interesting. You know, we also have Hawk. Hawk, when I see this character, he reminds me a lot of Kate Skywalker. I don't know why. Just maybe it's something about Jan's art style there that really likens back. We had those really big worms. They kind of remind you of the Dune worms. But something, and I always read too far into everything, but when Shay gets the Force Saber and she ignites it for the first time, the hish isn't black. It's light, and it's a purple, and by the time it gets to the end, it's darker. Okay, and then she's rushing to protect Sekhnos. And, you know, at that point, I see it as like she's in the light and she's starting to shift to the dark, you know, and you see it going from lighter to darker. Because when Kresh had it and he's swinging it around, it is black. Every word is in black. Now, when she swings it the second time after he force shoves her back, she turns around and jumps back at him. Obviously, she's ticked off. Now it's even darker. There's still a little purple hint to the edges of the wording, but it's gotten darker. And I don't know. For me, I think that's one of the things I love about comics as a medium. They leave you wondering, why did they do that? You know, granted, sometimes it's just a little error. The color guy forgot to match the colors. But sometimes it's not. I mean, maybe there's something going on there with the Force Saber. I mean, we know later she's not able to activate it. And she was the only one during the fight able to activate it. So you have to wonder if, once again, John and Jan have got... You know, it's almost like they're pulling a Joss Whedon. You know, they got it all laid out, and they're giving you little things. You don't even know that it's a thread going on into season 5, but it's here now.
Very true. I guess this would probably be a good place to cut, wouldn't you think? I mean, if we start talking characters, we're going to take up a whole other episode. So we should go ahead and probably close this off. And... Ladies and gentlemen, I guess you'll get a chance to check out more Dawn of the Jedi with us next week. Sound good?
Sounds like a plan.
All right. All right, folks, we are going to cut it there. We're going to come back to you next week with another episode on Dawn of the Jedi, this time focusing on the characters, what we know about them, where they came from, basically delving into the nuances, whereas it seems like now we've delved into a lot of the bigger picture kind of stuff. Remember, of course, you can listen to our show airing on Middle Earth Network Radio, as well as streaming on the Star Wars Report website, which is starwarsreport.com. Our episodes are also available right there off of our Facebook page at Star Wars Beyond the Films, or if you just want the actual URL, it's facebook.com/SWBeyondFilms. No matter how you get there, though, be sure to like our page if you have the moment. And drop us a review on iTunes or the Zoom Marketplace if you get the opportunity. Those are some of the best ways to let us know what you think about the show. Each month, we're going to release a feedback episode when there's enough material to justify one, so be sure to send along your thoughts. You can either catch us on Facebook, facebook.com/SWBeyondFilms, as I mentioned. Catch us on Twitter, at SWBeyondFilms, or you can email us. And we actually now have two email addresses that will work, because we're phasing one of them out. The original email address was beyondthefilms@starwarsfanworks.com. You can use that still if you want. That'll still be around for another year or so, but we're going to slowly phase it out as we get into our newer episodes and we have less chance of people listening to older episodes and catching that email address. I've also set up another one, which is swbeyondfilms@starwarsfanworks.com. So now you can find us on Twitter and Facebook and email us using that same thing, swbeyondfilms. It's just, you got to remember, it's at StarWarsFanWorks.com, whereas the website for the show is at StarWarsReport.com. We're doing the email through my website, but of course, we're hosted alongside the Star Wars Report with Bethany and Riley over there. So SW Beyond Films hopefully will make it a little bit easier to, you know, remember, so that it's easier for you to get in contact with us. So be sure to let us know what you think of Dawn of the Jedi and, of course, this episode. For now, this has been Nathan Butler,
Mark Herleman, and Whistler.
Saying, may the Force be with you.
And don't quote us the odds. Ain't that right, buddy?
That was a long-winded yes. You think maybe he said it depends?
I need to get a translator or a little USB port I can plug in.
Oh, no, wait, that's it. It's the Astromech version of, it all depends on your own point of view, or something like that.
POV! But he says it really long, like it's like, oh.
It's just like in Russian, you know, Zdravstvuyte is the way of saying hello. Wait, what? How do you spell that again?
Nice.
All right.